Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
I'm Nipin, founder of Unshackled Ventures, the only pre-seed venture fund for immigrant founders in the U.S.
Nitin, thanks so much for making time to join us on Ivy Podcast. I was very excited about this conversation coming up, mainly because there's just so much that I want to talk to you about, your thesis, even your own background, how it all came about. Before we jump straight to Unshackled, give us a thumbnail version of your career today.
Yeah, it's a compounding effect of a lot of micro decisions. I grew up in India, in Delhi, and when I was up for my first job after completing the CPA equivalent called CA in India, I wanted to take a job that gives me a lot of exposure to the different things that happen in a business, and definitely didn't want a desk job. So I kept looking for that job. I passed on the first 40 job offers until I found that one job at ABB where I would get to experience their 42 different business units and different functions. So, you know, that turned out to be a great decision because it set a great foundation for enterprises, how they operate in different aspects. So from a consumer business all the way to building multi-billion dollar transformers. And that took me to Deloitte. Someone at Deloitte noticed what I was doing at ABB and started chasing me down. And so, you know, after 6 months of chase, I met them and they offered me a job to integrate the India practice that they were setting up with the US. I did that. And then the US practice wanted me to come here. That's how I shifted to the US, which turned out to be another great decision. I was very fortunate that I landed in Silicon Valley, loved the culture, loved the innovation that was going on around us and the speed, which was different from the New York City speed, right? It was more hustle, but also in a different way. And so I built a practice at Deloitte in San Jose, focusing on startups. And that's how I really got into startups. Until then, I didn't really know much about, you know, what's this process through which big companies come about. Did that for about 4.5 years. A lot of companies that I worked with went public, went through M&A. All of this work was strategy and finance related. One of my clients was Chegg, which was started by an immigrant founder as well. The day after he got his green card, he started Chegg, the company that's now public. And while I was at Deloitte, he asked me if I would join him at his next startup and run strategy finance there. So I took that offer and from that, spent 2.5 years there. Last 6 months of my work there, I was moonlighting on a concept, trying to figure out if there's legs. And once we had a few paying customers, the co-founders decided we should go full time. And I was the only one who was on an H-1B. So that's when that question of how do I go full time became relevant, led to a whole journey of figuring immigration out. That was the first time someone told me in the US, you can't do this. This is the land of you can do whatever you want to do, right? And so so that led to the discovery process that ultimately became the origin for Unshackled Ventures. So I would say the career path has been very fortuitous, really organic in a way that the only jobs I interviewed for, fortunately, were my very first job. And after that, it's been one thing leading to another.
Well, that's super exciting and what a journey. I appreciate you sharing that with us. Definitely, you know, resonates on so many levels from the immigrant perspective, coming from, you know, also from Kazakhstan into US and following the corporate ladder. And then mine was a little bit different in the sense I had to learn how startups and fundraising, all of that works simply by just doing that, funding, launching my own startups, successfully failing a lot of them, and essentially kind of that path led me to angel investing, which, you know, I'm very active in right now. And we have our own mini kind of SPV with a group of my network that we invest together. But from, you know, from a similar path, you went working on startups and you got exposure into that. And your vision was to build your own fund. So walk us through that process as you were transitioning. You made the decision, you know, you had that, you know, the thesis around immigrant founders, which I want to talk to you a little bit separate. But in terms of launching your own fund, what did that process look like? Because it's not something you hear every day, you know, entrepreneurs or people just launching their, you know, venture funds. It's a very unique space. I've been, you know, I've been reading a lot about it, but it's not something as common as launching a startup. Tell us a little bit more about it, that process. What are some of the challenges that were very, you know, that you did not predict? What were some of the risks that you couldn't even, you know, think of? Just tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, that's a great observation. Among a lot of unexpected twists in my life, I never thought I would be a VC. And even when we started Unshackled, we didn't think we're becoming VCs. You know, my dad was a small business owner, so I got to learn a lot of the small business operation working with him, then working at enterprise like ABB, and then working for or at startups once I came to the US. The VC roadmap was never on the charts, but ultimately when we started envisioning the solution that Unshackled would be, which was all with the founder at the center of it, right? So with the immigration friction that exists, the founder is the one who loses the time, and time is that one thing that you just can't buy enough, right? So we kind of looked at it from a perspective of what can we do to amplify the founder's time. That solution became a combination of R&D lab and what is a VC model, because we didn't want to charge founders a service fee for what we were doing for them. So then we looked at what's the other way to monetize this, and turns out that the VC model is the best way to monetize a founder journey, because you have a lot of risk upfront, a high reward down the road, and with what you do, you want to be a part of that entire journey. So that was kind of this unexpected oh shit moment for my partner and I. It's like, you know, we were customers of VC till now, and now we're becoming one. But the ethos of how we built Unshackled till now and how we continue to build is very startup-like. It's not going to be the scale that a software startup sees, but it's a kind of this small, medium-sized service business with very high focus on customers. We had to learn the ropes of what is important from a VC standpoint. And so when we decided that the structure of what we do is going to be a fund structure, we then had to figure out how we're going to learn about the nuances of VC, because it's not just about sourcing deals. It's not just about investing, right? A lot of the nuances of how you become a successful VC go into things like, who do you want to invest in out of the big pipeline that you build? Would they take your money if you want to invest in them? And then what do you do post-investment? And so all those things we had to learn on the fly. We're very fortunate that as we went on to raise our first fund, we raised it from people who had been angel investing for a long period of time, seed investing for a long period of time, and we got to learn from them. So we took our time in observing them and learning from them. We were very candid in terms of asking questions that we didn't know about. For example, portfolio construction. Well, what is that? How do you go about it? And you know, just being open about what we don't know gave us a lot of wisdom from people around us. That's one of the magical things about being in Silicon Valley, is if you want to learn something, there's a lot of people who can teach you what you want to learn. You have to be open to it. So so we went through that very fast and extensive learning curve in our fund one. By the time we got to fund two, we had a much better understanding of what being a VC is like. And one of the toughest things for me to learn was, you are not in control of the situation. As a VC, the only decisions you control are really to invest or not to invest, and then when to exit. if you have that option, right? And so in between that, you can have some influence if you are the kind of investor who likes to be involved. But you don't control micro decisions, which is very different from the company building that we were doing. Like, we control decisions for how we build them, Shackle, but not portfolio companies. And the results of if we're good or bad at our jobs are going to show up years later, right? So that gestation cycle, the feedback loop is very slow. Those adjustments took a little bit of time, but I think, you know, with the support we've had around us, we've learned fast and learned in a fire hose way. The team that we built around us kind of made it easier as well, because our partner Maria joined us in 2015, and you know, she's the one who's earned herself into the partnership. Manan and I started the firm, so we were by default the partners, and we had to learn everything on our own. Maria went through this really strong learning curve with a lot of peers, and she's one of the most well-respected upcoming VCs. And so, you know, we get to learn from her on how she runs a lot of these processes. So I would say it's been a fantastic journey. And the beauty now, when we look at it as a portfolio of, you know, with 60 something investments, almost 50 active companies, we get to be part of these many businesses, not just one business that we would be building. And so it's a fantastic ride.
Wow, that's definitely, you know, and it seems like a very exciting and, you know, unpredictable journey as well, going through that decision-making process. And for our listeners, majority of whom are, you know, technology and executives on the corporate sector, that's, you know, as my background, I focused on that initially, but we also have quite a few entrepreneurs, investors themselves. And I don't know if, you know, everyone's fully familiar with how the venture capital firm is structured. And I want to take a stab at, you know, decomposing that, and you correct me if where I'm wrong, where a venture capital firm typically raises multiple funds, you know, typically starts with a fund one, working with high net worth individuals whom, you know, refer to as LPs, limited partners. And it's essentially a very similar process as I would raise for a startup, where you pitch your vision, you pitch your deck, you pitch your approach and strategy. And basically, once that fund is raised, then you deploy that capital to invest into startups. But it's a long shelf life, right? It's, you know, between 7 and 12 years, so, you know, right, the existence of the startups. So tell us a little bit more that, you know, the very first fund that you set out to raise. I'm not sure how much track record you actually had at the time as an investor. But I would say, you know, majority of fund managers who raise their original funds don't have a lot of track record. So would you attribute that process or more decision making on LP side, more investment into you as the fund manager? Tell us a little bit more about that process. How hard was it? I talked to so many fund managers in the past, and I hear some stories between 500 to 2000 meetings in a year. It's, you know, some mind blowing stats.
Yeah, they're definitely doing it better than us, I would say. Look, I think for us, it was, for the first fund, it was very much what you said. It was a startup-like pitch, which is you're investing in the founders and the strategy and the product that we're building, because the founders are going to buy that product. Founders are our customers. But I would say generally from a landscape standpoint, I think there are largely three ways in which you enter VC or you start your own fund. And the most prominent, most traditional, conventional way is the apprenticeship model, right? So for the longest time, VC's been an apprenticeship-based industry. So you go join a firm, you learn there, and then when you're ready to start your own shop, you step out and you start your own shop. If you think of it, a lot of the professional services firms are born that way, right? You think of law, you think of banking, that's been the path. It's worked. That's the most conventional. But about 20 years ago, a shift that started happening was, if you were a successful founder, you could take your learnings as a founder and now start investing and use those learnings as a founder to help other founders build their companies. And so you saw this rise of operator turned operator turned VC. And then there's a very small group of accidental VCs, I would say, where we fall is in this accidental VC, where we started with solving a problem, turned out VC model was the best way to structure that. And I think that model only works when your customer is founders and you have a very unique product to sell. Otherwise, you go through the apprenticeship model or the successful founder turned VC model. When you take a path like ours, it's best to approach it as a startup. You raise your small sort of, call it the pre-seed equivalent round to prove the key hypotheses, right? When we started, the key hypotheses that we went in with was, number one, that immigration is a big pain point, and if we're solving that, founders are going to want to buy that product. Number two, that we can actually build a product, which means we can solve for the immigration impasse that we're talking about. And number three, that if founders want a product and we can build that product, that the economics will be such that it's worth building this product. But, you know, every startup has to answer those questions. And so the focus for fund one was, let's raise from two types of people. One, who like to invest in that pre-seed stage, so we had a lot of angels. And two, people who we can learn from. So we had a lot of VCs from seed stage to Series A VCs. And you know, we told them, look, what we are doing is expanding the pie of entrepreneurs. The immigrant founder who's on a visa, for example, who's currently not investable because they haven't quit their job, they can't focus on the startup full time, they're not a part of the startup ecosystem today. They are an employee at a big company. If we bring them into the startup pie, we're now, the pie is bigger for everybody to work with. And so that appealed to investors in our first fund. And that's how we secured that first fund, largely with angels. Started with people we had worked with, which was three of them. And then we just hustled our way to combination of cold emails and then tracking down leads and everyone who committed in, going through their connections and asking them for intros pretty shamelessly and pursuing those intros is how that first one came together. But it was essential for us to prove those things. And really that's what happened. We proved that really high caliber founders who were born somewhere not in the US, so born outside the US, who had come to the US for education or for work, are on visas, they now want to start their companies. We invest in them, we can secure strong starting ownership for a relatively small investment, which is, you know, pre-seed was a relatively new concept at the time. People weren't calling it pre-seed, but it was that equivalent of the first check, the friends and family round type of investment. And as we proved that, we now had to go into fund two, we had a little more credibility that, yeah, you guys proved these hypotheses. And now I can see investing in immigrants is great business. Immigrants build great companies. And with the product services that you offer, you can secure really good investments and really good founders. So that's how the second fund came about. But I wouldn't say we've crossed the chasm yet, right? So from an LP standpoint, because we're still largely in the individual angels, family office realm of LPs. As only now are we becoming relevant to institutional LPs because there's a lot more data points that this strategy works. And so one of the, to your point about difference between building a startup and building a VC fund is you have to recognize that because each fund is a new unit on its own versus in a startup, each round is a new unit, but you're still part of that one entity. With funds, every new fund is a new set of portfolio companies that you're gonna get into. And so LPs have the opportunity to wait. Now, some of them will miss out because if you're really successful, if you're good at what you do, you're going to continue to raise from those who believed in you early in your life cycle. You're not going to go to new LPs because funds tap out. And as we think about our journey, we want to keep investing at this day zero time, right? When companies are just being formed. So we're not going to raise those mega funds. We think we're going to tap out at just about 100 million or under that in terms of full extent. And So therefore, there will come a time when we can't add new LPs, and the memories will be there of who were the ones who supported us and backed us before all the proof point was there versus those who chose to wait. So that's one big difference in terms of fundraising, is you kind of have to pick those who believe in you and believe in the strategy versus those who are just looking at metrics.
Well, that's great. Definitely seems like, you know, the life of a startup brings back a lot of memories, you know, through the fundraising process. And you've made some references, you know, shameless asking for, you know, recommendations. It goes along with kind of that entrepreneurial pedigree to be able to kind of just find creative ways to build that framework, to build, you know, to find these unique talents and unique opportunities, mm-hmm. which brings me to the further point. As you know, you've mentioned that you guys invest day zero into founders, mm-hmm. obviously immigrant founders, which, you know, to me that resonates on so many levels, mainly because being myself an immigrant and having launched startups multiple times, it was always a challenge to find somebody who would believe in you where you don't have a lot of, you know, maybe track record to show or an actual product to validate or things like that. So I used that experience into forming kind of some of my own strategy and thesis, so to say, when I invest into startups, where for me, it's important to look at kind of the almost the digital breadcrumbs of the founder and to look at their history. You know, like what were some of the things you've done, let's say, in college? Did you join the club or did you build a club? Were you a navigator? Were you a cartographer? Did you create the map for others to follow? So that matters a lot to me from that perspective. And then kind of the entrepreneurial pedigree that I've referenced to in terms of what have you done before, I think that's very interesting. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how do you approach that as you start talking to some of the very interesting founders. On day zero, what are some of the evaluation criteria that, you know, helped you in, you know, improve your batting average when it comes to making those extremely early investments?
Yeah, great question. Great also context on how you think about it. Look, I we're still learning, so we don't know if we've really perfected the art, but if directional indicators are anything to go by, we believe our playbook is working. And so one of the things that when we started investing, we looked at was nobody really invests until there's some social signals. And, you know, there's some investors who will say, we only invest in people. Almost all investors say we invest in people. But the question really is, you invest in people plus something. That plus something is either a social signal from where you work, the universities you went to, or social signal from you have customer traction, you have user data. So it's kind of people plus something. What we're investing in truly is about 60, 67% of the times we incorporate the companies with the founder. So not a line of code has been written. There are no customers or users. So it's really the people you're investing in. And so we asked ourselves, how do we evaluate if these founders, what is a startup, but it's really a team of two or three founders, if we should invest in them? And the answer that came back was, do we believe that these can be company builders, large company builders in the future? Not based on what they have done, but based on the distance they have traveled. And that is, it's very subjective. There's no like formula that we can write about, you know, if X, Y, and Z happen, we should invest, and if not, we shouldn't. It's a subjective thing, but trying to practice that, we learned that we were talking a lot more about the founders and a lot less about the business model, the product, the customer. And that allowed us the opportunity to go into some of the things that you just referenced, which is you were born on a coconut farm. Today, you're building a VC-backed company in San Francisco. How? Like, what transpired in between? But the opportunity to get to know that this founder was born in a coconut farm only comes about when you really engage into, tell us about where you're coming from. Where did you start? Where are you today? And I think we practice that so much that even the newest team members that we bring about, within a few pitches, they see that the flavor here is more about the people and less about the business. We do talk about the business because we want to invest in things that will hit escape velocity, or in other words, we don't want to invest in things that are not scalable. However, we also know that most of the times, these products and companies change wildly, and you know, markets evolve. If you're backing the right founder, and you know that the founder has ambitions to solve big problems, you know that they're not going to waste their time on incremental small things. So most of the times we've been right in that if these founders realize that the market they were going after was small, they didn't want to operate in that. They pivoted, they changed quickly. Nobody had to tell them, but they themselves realized this is you can't build a big solution to this, and here's an alternative way to do it. So I think our biggest asset has been building this muscle around get to know the people and see if we can pick signals that indicate that they can be big company builders in the future. And that applies to almost all first-time founders that we invest in. Some come with pedigree, worked at Stripe, worked at Airbnb, worked at Google. And so you can go, okay, there's been some level of validation of their execution capability, but not as a founder, as an employee of this big organization. So you still have different questions to ask on how they operate when resources are very limited. Other times you have founders that didn't go to Ivy League schools, that didn't work at big companies, maybe dropouts from high school. And there you're asking very different set of questions. But you're still trying to get to this one thing is, do they value their time? Will they waste time on small things? You know, are they coachable? Are they self-aware with respect to their strengths and not strengths? How resourceful are they? What could they do to maximize all the resources that are around them? And how likable are they? Are they going to be people who can recruit really competitive talent? Because likability is one thing that doesn't get talked about, but it really comes down to, in working with people, just are you likable or not? You know, charisma kind of plays some role in that, but likability also comes in other forms. Like you may have so much technical gravitas that that people love spending time with you. So it's you know, that's how a lot of it got shaped. And I would say 80-90% of the evaluation is, can we see these founders as big company builders? And then let's go figure out if the space they are thinking of operating in right now has the capability to become a big company vertical.
Very insightful. I'm looking right now at an article in TechCrunch about Unshackled Ventures, and the, you know, it talks a lot about you, the founding team, your co-founder, and it brings me to a point that I also utilize when I evaluate the startups from a founder perspective in terms of that team design. You've mentioned something around the context of being self-aware in terms of your strengths and weaknesses and how you actually design the team. I think, you know, it's very important when it comes to, you know, evaluating the founders. Do you understand your strengths and weaknesses, and who is your co-founder? Who is the team? Tell us a little bit more about your process of designing your team. How did you come about that? What was the story behind? How did that actually help in terms of, you know, formulating the overall thesis of, you know, how you guys decide to invest? Curious to hear a little bit more about that, you know, that thought process.
Yeah, very unique question. I don't get that often. So Manan and I worked together at Know, the edtech startup that I joined after Deloitte. He came in as part of marketing team. By the time I left, he was running the marketing team. We built a really good working relationship, almost a friendship, while we were there. And then after I left and started building my startup, I consulted him often on marketing ideas, just because he is a phenomenal communicator. And so we had a really good working relationship. Coincidentally, after Know, he was born here in Silicon Valley to immigrant parents. And so he didn't have to really think about immigration and visas until, you know, he started a company with a visa holder co-founder. And so he went, as an American, he went through the same sort of friction points as I was going through for myself. And we reminisced about it. So when I told him what I'm conceptualizing, he immediately was drawn into it. And you know, my mental model about Manan as a co-founder partner was, he has a very different analytical framework than I do. He's a very different personality than I am. We complement each other more than we overlap with our thinking. And what it translates into is, we the same problem set will approach in very different ways and come out with a similar or similar-ish solution, but from different points. And that gives us the capability to counter each other really well, knowing that we trust each other, we respect each other's viewpoint a lot. There's also a very strong emotional intelligence difference between us. I am much more of a logic and rational decision maker, and Manan is amazing with his emotional intelligence, emotional quotient. So he compliments me a lot on appreciating just culturally the way I grew up, emotions and feelings weren't a big thing that you need to care about. And so I still am working on that aspect of myself, but he compliments me really well on, oh, maybe, you know, if someone's asking for this, they're coming from this place and let's understand those feelings. And so he's amazing at that. So that complementary analytical framework, emotional framework gave us a really good starting point. And so then when we started looking at team members, we were like, we absolutely don't want to hire people like ourselves. That's the worst thing we can do. And one of the things somewhere subconsciously I learned in my career was I don't want to be the smartest person in the room. So I always kind of found ways to be around people who were all much smarter than me. And I was always learning from them. And that's kind of the case with how we've built our team here is everybody we hire has an element of being smarter than I am. So as long as I can confidently say I am not the smartest person in the room, I feel good about our team. So when we brought on Maria, who's a refugee from Colombia, grew up in Orlando, Florida, she has a policy and communications background. And so, you know, she has a completely different way of looking at things. And so that started complementing us well. We brought on Sarah, who's grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. So, you know, again, her perspectives are different than ours. And so as we continue to build our team, it's an extremely diverse team, not just in gender and race and where we come from, but in thoughts. And we've built a culture where nobody is judged for their ideas. Nobody's judged for their opinions. We hold our opinions, but we are also all very open to others countering our opinions with theirs. And if we learn something new, we all feel pretty proud of the fact that we can change our opinions with new information that's brought to light. And so I think this team kind of flourishes in that environment of I can be weird with my team and it's okay. I can be, I don't have to be insecure about it. I'm going to get judged. I hope as we grow, we can keep that culture and continue to get more diversity into our team.
Right. I love the framework of hiring for strength versus the lack of weakness, which is something I've picked up in Ben Horowitz's book, The Hard Thing About the Hard Things, which was eye-opening when it comes to interviewing and, you know, talent acquisition in general, because we always tend to focus so much on the past experience when we hire. And it's such a flawed approach, because I was recently talking to an executive from Amazon and she, you know, made it very clear in terms of improving your batting average when you interview, when you hire, really focusing on that particular strength that's missing on the team. And to your point, which is very, you know, unique in the sense, not being the smartest person in the room and trying to surround yourself with that diversity from that perspective, which actually, you know, the whole reason I launched this podcast is for that particular exact reason. I wanted access to people who are much smarter, much more connected, much more successful than me.
Well, sorry to disappoint you today.
No, it's actually one of the better ones. Absolutely.
But you're right. I mean, look, the approach has to be in an industry that's largely about outliers. You have to play to win. You can't play to not lose. Right. If you're playing to not lose, you are going to lose. And we're playing for wins. And so we're aggressive about hiring for the upside. And if we see that the upside is not there, then we work with the person we hire to figure out where they would be most successful and try to get them to that place. Because not everybody works in not everybody's successful in the kind of culture that we have in our firm. And so we're mindful of that as well. But We're not going to be, you know, Manan and I are both draw a lot of inspiration from sports and how in professional sports or in competitive sports, the strategies that you adopt replicate really well to winner take all type of industries. And being athletes in our younger days ourselves, we're in team sports, not individual sports, we get a lot of value from the strategies that work in team sports, right? You can you can be a star on a weak team, or you can be the weakest person on a star team. You choose which one, but I would rather be the weakest one on a star team and keep winning championships.
I love that analogy. That's definitely very unique. The one aspect that I love asking every investor and every VC is, what is your go-to? I'm pretty sure you have a series of go-to questions that you love asking the entrepreneurs. But if you were to single out one or two, the ones that really throw that curveball, that your favorite. The reason I ask that is because, and I shamelessly stole that from Kanye Macubela. He's with Kindred Ventures. And yeah, one of the questions that he mentioned in terms of his favorite is, what are the risks that I'm completely, you know, underrating when it comes to your particular business or the startup you're building? Which was, I love that framework, because it really makes you, puts you in a position to think of something that not so obvious. So share with me some of those that in your kind of arsenal that you pull out when, you know, you're not sure.
Yeah, I'm much more, you know, I'm a risk manager myself. So I know that I can factor in the risks myself to a great extent. But what I like to learn from the founders is what's the success scenario? And so it's not so much a curveball question, but really trying to look at the world from their perspective and see if they are successful, what does the world look like? And that gives me the then capability to look at where we are today to how much better is the world if they succeed in accomplishing what they're trying to accomplish. And so I think that's one of the more enlightening questions, but I still think that the best information does not really come from necessarily these go-to questions, but it comes from really listening to what founders are saying and then asking questions that are kind of relevant to what they are saying. Just selfishly, kind of because we focus so much on the people, a lot of those questions happen to be about them and less about the upside from the business or upside or risks for the business. Really, like for example, how do you prioritize your time? What's the framework on what do you spend your time on? And that's, it doesn't matter what business you're running. Your time is your time, and what do you spend on? Like, what's important to you? Why are you doing this? There's a lot of different ways to get into that information, but we tend to be more conversational and less sort of, here's my set of questions that I need to get through.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely can relate to that, because at the end of the day, you want to be a friend, not a parent, to the founder that you invest in, and have being able to build that connection from the very first conversation. I think that matters so much. So to your point, it's not all about the type of question, but having that chemistry, having that, you know, feeling that energy with the founder. I think it's actually one of the more important ingredients. In closure, I have a twofold question from LP perspective and from the emerging fund manager perspective. As an LP, you know, I'm still getting my feet wet. I'm trying to be a lot better LP, and I'm trying to learn that space. For me, it's very new. You know, I've invested myself, but being able to, be that limited partner at the same time, you know, it's a unique space. So you've dealt with, you know, hundreds of LPs. What advice would you give for those that are looking to join different funds? What are some of the areas that really stand out to you when it comes to building that successful relationship with LP? Tell me a little bit more about that.
I am definitely not the expert at that. I can think of a number of people who would be much better resource for that. But I think you can kind of segment this space in a few different ways. So are you an endowment LP or are you a wealth builder LP, right? So when you think of it from endowment principle standpoint, the first principle is wealth conservation. And that's why endowment portfolios are going to be constructed in a very different way versus if you're trying to be an LP or if you're planning to be an LP because you want to build your wealth. And then the questions you have to ask in those situations is, besides the return that you can make on your investment in a fund, what else are you seeking? Are you seeking direct investment opportunities in the companies that are coming through this investment in a fund? Are you seeking knowledge by talking to the founders that are coming through this fund? We have a number of LPs who are not necessarily LPs in the traditional sense of the word. They're LPs by virtue of being an investor in our fund. And their motivations largely fall in one of three categories. Above the three is obviously they believe that we're gonna make a ton of money and their investment's going to be one of the better investments. But in addition to that, they are seeking one, they have angel investment plans and they're like, I just don't have the time to go through thousands of companies. You guys are seeing 2,000 companies a year. You do the curation. The companies that you invest in, I'll look at those and I'll pick the ones that I'm most aligned with to then invest after you. So it's kind of their own pipeline building mechanism without doing all the work to go build a pipeline, take thousands of meetings with founders and then invest. Number two is they are executives at whatever corporation and where they are in that position, they want to be aware of what's coming next, right? So it's a knowledge objective and they may also invest in some companies, they may advise some companies, but the primary thing they're looking for is what's coming next. I want to be aware of that. And because you guys operate at a stage where you're seeing things before they really become trends, I want to be close to you guys. And then there's the third bucket, which is I just want to meet great people. And the founders you're investing in are amazing people. So by being an LP in this fund, I get to see all these stories, I get to meet these folks, and where I can help, I will help. So it's kind of a combination of great returns with something else that really motivates them. For some, it's just the impact that, you know, you're equalizing opportunities for immigrants in this country and you're giving them not just the capital, but also equalizing them from an immigration status standpoint, equalizing the access they have to customers, investors, talent. So there's a little bit of that impact built into that. If that's the case, then, you know, for you as an LP, I would say kind of figure out what your priority order is in achieving what objectives you want to achieve. And that'll give you a good framework to say, if I'm backing someone and backing their strategy, how well does that align with my goals? Because, you know, as an individual or through the syndicate taking LP positions, chances are you're not writing the institutional size, 7, 8, 9 figure checks. And so in that scenario, it's best to be upfront about this is what I want to accomplish and see how every fund that I meet, how does that align into what I want to accomplish?
No, I love that framework in the sense that there's just so many variables that go into that decision-making process, which is, you know, it's interesting. It's a whole, you know, it's an art and a science. It's, there's no black and white. There's a lot in between. And I think I love that journey, just being able to learn from that perspective. Then last but not least, who are some of the role models or the kind of the VCs in your space that you really look up to, that you try to, you know, you try to learn from? Give us some examples from that perspective. Would love to hear that.
Yeah, being very fortunate to, you know, at Know have worked with Andreessen Horowitz. So, you know, Mark and Scott Cooper were very involved in our journey at Know, and I've had the luxury or privilege of having that relationship with them. So learn a lot from their perspectives. Kittu Kaluri is another VC that I respect a lot. He is not into hype. He is, you know, very sort of to the business kind of guy, but has built one of the best portfolios in the Valley and has really unique perspectives on journeys, which are kind of different from the shiny object approach and raise all you can type of approach that we're seeing in today's market, which is only going in one direction as of now. And you know, besides that, just within, for example, within our portfolio, some co-investors, you know, I think people like Maha Ibrahim, for example, is pretty phenomenal, and get to hear from our portfolio founders and how great they've been in helping them. Josh Kopelman has been a source of inspiration and source of wisdom. There's a lot of, the advantage of being in the age we're today is we get to learn from people without them even knowing that we're learning from them. And so some of that is incredible, just a function of the times we're in. But some of the folks I mentioned have been directly impactful in shaping my thought process.
Look, you've been so generous with a lot of information today. I can't thank you enough for a very short, insightful conversation. You know, I personally learned quite a bit from this. What I love doing with a lot of guests on the pod is doing a follow-up recording in about a year to see how much I've changed. We revisit the conversation from a year ago and basically take a look at what are some of the things we've covered, if still applies. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you, and I really appreciate your time today.
That was a great, great conversation. Very insightful questions.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.